Good morning, everybody. You guys have been doing great jobs with the memos or with the reflections. Basically, for those of you who have handed them in, you've gotten full credit, so you can know that you're doing well and you're answering them just the way that I was hoping. And definitely the questions are very helpful that you put in there, because then I can incorporate them into the lectures and make sure that we're not missing certain things. And if for some reason you miss class, all the classes are being recorded, so you can still listen to the recording and write a personal response to the audio version of the lecture. Okay, so pull out a piece of paper, and I want to do another exercise where I want you to think about a time when you felt like you experienced discrimination because of your identity. So a time where you experienced some type of discrimination because of your identity, because of your race, because of your gender, because of your age, because of your class, some situation where you felt like you experienced discrimination on some level. And now turn to someone near you and make sure you introduce yourself and then share about the experience. Okay, how about if some of you share some of the examples that you came up with, an example of where you felt, where you experienced discrimination. Jesse?
Religious discrimination.
In what way?
I'm Jewish, so uh-huh. Just negative stereotypes towards Jewish people.
Okay, here on campus or at home?
Not here on campus.
Okay,
more at home.
Uh-huh, that's a good example. What other situations did you come up with? Olivia?
In high school, I was in this thing called Extreme Sports Club, which I was the only girl. We basically just went paintballing, and it felt like everyone was kind of just confused when I was there.
Uh-huh. They were thrown off by it. But you continued to participate?
Yeah.
That's great. What other examples? Matthew?
We were kind of talking about at work. I used to work at Menards, and I was like one of the younger guys.
Uh-huh.
So they always assumed that I could like lift all the heavy stuff. I mean, I didn't have a problem with it, but you know, no one else could seem to get it done.
Uh-huh. So you do all the heavy lifting would get dumped on you?
Yeah.
What about up in this section? Jeff?
So I was like playing a game with some people I just recently met, and I invited them to like Skype so I could talk to, you know, better communicate over the game. I didn't know them before, but they're like kind of older people, like high 20s, I assume. And then, so it showed like my name on like my Skype account. And then, so I guess like I don't remember if it, I got an argument with the guys or I just like wasn't doing so good in that one game. But at the end, they were like just like saying like racial slurs and stuff.
Hmm.
And then, yeah, just like didn't play them afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Did your username identify your race or ethnicity?
Not my in-game name, but like my Skype has like my actual name on there.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm thinking of a friend of mine. She is Caucasian, but she married a Chinese-American person and took his last name. And so her last name now is Chang, Jennifer Chang. And when it's just emails or whatever, there's no visual, and they see, oh, Jennifer Chang, they have a certain picture of what she is like. And then when she shows up for the interview or for the meeting or whatever, they're not expecting that Jennifer Chang is a white female. And so it throws them off. So a lot of times something like a username or email address can communicate something that's opposite or different from what's being expected. One thing that I find interesting is that we tend to think of discrimination as a negative thing, like we're discriminated against. But discrimination in and of itself is a neutral word. It means that you're discriminating or sort of deciphering between, sort of choosing between, you have discriminating taste, like you can differentiate. And so discrimination, just as a term, is a neutral term. It doesn't have sort of, it isn't a negative term or a positive term, it's just neutral. But then how it's applied determines whether it's a positive or negative action. And so, you know, we often talk about being discriminated against, but it can also be the case that you're discriminated for, like that you're selected because of certain categories or criteria and discriminated in a positive sense or being getting benefits because of it. And so one of the big topics that has come up and continues to be sort of an ongoing debate is related to affirmative action in college admissions. There's also affirmative action in hiring, but I thought affirmative action in college admissions would be something very relevant to this group. And it's an open question still of whether or not public universities should have affirmative action admission policies, where people are admitted, or basically a person's race or other category is used in the admission process as sort of part of the score count for students. And I'm curious, in this classroom, where you stand on that perspective of whether or not you think public universities should have affirmative action admission policies. And so if you're a strong advocate of affirmative action admission policies, we're all going to stand up, but if you're a strong advocate of affirmative action policies, I want you to come to this end of the room. And then if you're a strong opponent of affirmative action policies, I want you to go to that end of the room. And then if you're sort of like in the middle, obviously you can stand in the middle. And so this is basically from a policy perspective. Like if you're a university administrator, or if you were a Supreme Court justice and you had to decide on whether or not affirmative action policies should be implemented within public universities, you're going to give a response. Yes, Olivia?
Does that mean like a certain percentage has to be admitted? Is that what you mean?
Well, I know that they're all done differently, but basically it's saying that, you know, when they do admissions policies, they look at your SAT scores, your GPA. Another category of assessment would be person's race or other designated social categories. So as far as how much that would be weighted varies by institution, but to even have that be one of the categories is sort of what's open for question. If basically, or the other, you know, the opponents would say race shouldn't even be put on the application because it shouldn't be part of the decision-making criteria. So if you're if you think affirmative action policies are good and are beneficial for society and for public institutions, come up to this end. And then if you're an opponent of it, go down to that end. If you're sort of undecided or just unsure or you see the pros and cons, go put yourself in the middle. Okay, and we're gonna stretch it out a little bit so you can have space and see each other. So Jeff, come down this way. Sam, come down. I'm not putting you all the way at the end, but just stretch out so we can see each other. And then someone who is a strong opponent of affirmative action policy, I want you to explain why you're opposed to affirmative action policies.
I've done like a lot of research, especially on like blacks and the whole affirmative action issue, and I just don't think that it's fair that a black student would get extra points just because of their skin color. And it's like we complain about being separated and being seen as the other group, but then when it, I guess, serves to benefit us in a way, then it's okay. And so I feel like we either need to pick one side or the other, and I feel like why is it fair that the black student gets to take away the spot that Asian or a white student or a Hispanic student could have got because we're black. I feel like it should be based on qualifications, and the black student is not as qualified as the other racial groups of the students, and they shouldn't get in. I mean, a lot of us have had the same opportunity in high school to work, and if you didn't work hard enough, then you shouldn't be admitted. Like, colleges should not hand you anything. Like, that's the purpose of working to apply to get into the schools you want to. It takes effort, and I feel like handing somebody something because of their ethnic group is not fair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Very good. Anyone else? One other person in the back that's opposed to affirmative action. Cole.
I think you got to work for what you want, and you shouldn't be handed anything. I mean, that's basically it.
Uh-huh. So there shouldn't be any just bonuses that are sort of added on top. Okay, so someone that's in the middle, you're in the middle not because you want to just play it safe, but you're in the middle because you sort of see the pros and the cons, and you're actually torn. Is there anyone that sort of fits that category, where you're kind of like, I don't know, it's a tough call? Yeah, thank
you. Well, I went to school in Chicago, like downtown Chicago, and like the inner city kids, like they're majority black, and those schools like honestly are not as good as like the suburban schools or like the private schools in Chicago, and like I don't know, it's just they're really not given like the same fair opportunity. Like they have to go through metal detectors every single day.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, but I see like what she's saying, like everyone could work like their butt off and get into like college, like they really work their butt off, but they're really not like given the same opportunities.
Mm-hmm. I would say it's not a very easy question to answer. It's not a straightforward like, oh, of course it should be this way or that way. So it's very true. What about on this end, people who would lean more towards being in favor of affirmative action policies?
Yeah, I was thinking about like similar to what you're thinking, Mercedes, like how people shouldn't be handed like scholarship just because of their race and such like that. But at him as well, like inner city students just aren't given the same opportunities, and it's just, I mean, the majority of the people are like what, 70% white, and it's just so much harder for like black students or Asian students to like get the same opportunities as everyone else. I mean, like scholarships should be like given on merit, but it's just so much harder when they're, you know, just like different teachers and different like institutions, just they have to work so much harder. And like I would definitely like, if there's like a black student with like a 3.0 in like inner city, I'd pick him over like a 3.5 and like a white student in like a public institution, just because I know how much more like effort he put in, and just he shows how much of like a harder worker he is, and that's why I think it'd be better to, you know, incorporate him to like into the IU or like a public college, for their hard work and such like that, and increase diversity.
Yes, Mercedes.
I'd like to add something. So what you were just saying. My standpoint is not on. Like how you just said, if there was a black student or Asian student with a 3.0 versus a 3.5, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, like, I feel like if you admit the black student that has the 2.5 versus that 3.5, that's not fair. I get that that some inner cities, like you guys were saying, that's very true, but there's a thin line between what's taking it too far, and I feel like accepting the 2.5 black student because they're black, because they were given these bonus points, is not fair when there was somebody that got this 3.0 or this 3.5. Like, that 2.5 is taking it too far. Just because you're black doesn't mean that, like, I get that black people and Asians and a lot of other groups here in the United States may not get the same chances as a lot of white people, depending on where you're from.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a 2.5,
I think that's too low as well, between like
3.5. Yeah.
It's hard to draw a line.
Right.
I mean, all the different applicants or the people who do review the applications are, they're all different.
Yeah,
so it's hard to draw a line.
Yeah.
Just like another point, I don't think affirmative action should be strictly based off of race.
Mm-hmm.
I think it should also be based off like the institution of where the student's coming out from.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, if you were just to look at an inner city student in a downtown Chicago area where a kid walks through a metal detector every day, and then you look at another student from a great private school or a great public institution anywhere else in the country, let's say New York, I mean, that should really outweigh the pros and cons rather than whether he's white, black, Hispanic, Latin, whatever the descent is.
Yeah. And that's where sort of stereotypes are used in an efficient way of like, well, let's just look at race because there's a correlation between race and socioeconomic status. But that's where it breaks down, is that correlation isn't always exact, and that there could be a white student who grew up in a inner city urban setting and a black student who grew up in a white upper middle class suburban setting. And so it's efficient to just use race because you can just say what it is, whereas to explain your experience, you know, just think of the application review process of trying to discern who fits into which background profile. Yeah.
I was just thinking, I don't think there was one college application that I filled pulled out that didn't have the race question on it, even.
So all of them asked your race.
Yeah. So like, and I applied for 10 to 13 different colleges.
Uh huh.
So I mean, I didn't even see one that.
Yeah, so most of them put race on there because they want to collect statistics and actually also demonstrate that they're not discriminating against certain races. So if all of a sudden you had like 95% of the black applicants were rejected, they need to sort of be able to defend why that was the case. So you also, when you guys filled out your application or when you guys apply for scholarships, there's a question on there that asks about race typically, and you have the option to not disclose race. I'm curious, just by raising your hand, if you've recently filled out an application and you decided to not indicate your race, you know, you took the liberty to say, well, I'm just not going to disclose my race, I want you to raise your hand if you've utilized that option saying, I'm not going to disclose my race. So all of you disclose your race. That's good. Statistically, do you know which racial group is most likely to not disclose their race?
White
people. And because there's this psychological thought of like, gosh, I'd actually might be put at a disadvantage if I disclose that I'm white. And so it really skews a lot of these applications, because it looks like a lot of times with these scholarships and stuff that it's overrepresented by racial minorities. But a lot of that is because the white applicants are the large majority that say, I'm not going to disclose my race. So it's just, you know, there's things aren't always as they appear, and there's different processes going on that affect the demographics of who's applying for things or who we think is applying. So you guys can go back to your seats. So, and there's this underlying assumption that the value of a student is based on how smart or accomplished they are. I mean, a lot of you said GPE, you referenced GPA and sort of how well they've performed at their home, at their high school institution. And so that's one criteria, like, you know, we want the smartest students on campus. But there's other ways that students add value to a university setting. You know, I don't think you just want the one dimension of how smart you are, or even just your highest GPA or SAT scores. And there's other, beyond race, there's other ways that people get a boost or a bonus on their application. One simple one is if you're an Indiana resident, you have a better chance of getting in to IU compared to an out-of-state student or compared to an international student. That's just by virtue of your residency in this state. This is a public institution that was set up for the residents of Indiana, and so you get an inherent boost by just being a resident. Is that good? Is that bad? Is that affirmative action? Is that discriminatory in some way against the out-of-state people? Other ways that people get a boost, where it isn't just purely based on academic scores, is if you have athletic abilities. There will be opportunities where a person can get bonus points on their application if they have exceptional athletic skills, and that's because those people are viewed as adding value to the university. And so there's bonus points put on an application for that. Is that affirmative action? Is that discriminating against people who don't have as good of athletic skills? Another one, and more so in private universities, is if one of your parents is a wealthy alumni of the institution, you would get bonus points. Again, is that affirmative action? Is that discriminatory? Think of the idea of like submitting your application to IU and slipping a $100 bill into the application packet as just, you know, just as something to consider as you look over my application. We would think that that would be egregious. You know, it's like, oh my goodness, that's so unfair. But there's a very quick parallel to people who contribute large amounts of money to the university. Maybe they don't put it in the actual application, but it's flowing into the institution that is being considered in the process. And so it isn't just sort of like, you know, everyone's on an equal playing field and we're just looking at your scores and we're just going to take the best student, you know, the highest scores, and there's a line and whoever is above that line gets in and whoever is below that line doesn't get in. It's not as simple as that. It's a much more complicated system But we tend to turn a blind eye to the other ways that people get bonus points on their application. And yet then when we talk about other forms of affirmative action, it's all of a sudden, wait a minute, that doesn't seem fair. And yet the other examples of discrimination that occurs, we sort of turn a blind eye to. And I think one thing that the universities have begun to do, and probably even in your application, is that you have opportunities to write in overcoming adversity or overcoming adverse experiences, where you can write out a more long form what your situation was and why maybe for you getting to this point was a huge accomplishment compared to someone else who was sort of on the fast track and was just sort of destined to be at this place and be ready to apply and get accepted to IU or whatever institution. For me, the question is more, what is the purpose of the university? And when we think about the student population, in what ways can students add value to the university experience? And if you can have sort of a broad view of that, that might change the way that you think about the admission policies. Just like, you know, universities have figured out that student athletes add value to the university, not only monetary value, but other aspects that they add to the university. And so the thing would be, as you're thinking about it, admitting people, whether or not you have an explicit affirmative action policy or quota, it's what are ways that students add value to the university. But there are people that are very much opposed to any type of affirmative action policy. To a large extent, what Mercedes shared and what other people had shared, there's a very prominent professor at Stanford University, African-American, Thomas Sowell, and we're just going to watch a clip where he was interviewed by Charlie Rose, who's PBS correspondent, who basically was asking him his views on affirmative action. And I think it's really helpful to hear both sides of the story, because in this class we're all about, or it's slanted, skewed towards pro-diversity and pro what are ways to increase diversity or be intentional about increasing diversity. Not everyone has that perspective, and there's some good arguments for the other side to sort of say, I would question whether or not we want to be carrying the banner for promoting diversity. And so, and this is one example.
Can't see any positive affirmative action.
I don't doubt
that. In fact, it increased the pool, as you know, it's frequently used the expression of what affirmative action can do is increase the pool.
I don't know what that means, and I've never had anybody explain it to me. I've studied affirmative action in this country, in India, in Malaysia, you know, in Sri Lanka, in Nigeria. They have some version of it in Israel.
Well, let me explain as it was explained to me. It is the notion of, let's say you're on the admissions committee at Harvard. And you're going to choose so many people. You're going to let people in for a variety of reasons. One, sheer academic merit. They scored 1,600 on the college board. That's a good entry. They've got a brilliant academic and athletic background, and they happen to be a virtuoso violin player.
Oh, yeah.
And the violin player helps.
Yeah.
Or let's say they come from Nevada. They don't have a lot of Nevada at Harvard. And let's also say that they come from Sri Lanka. They don't have many people from Sri Lanka there. And let's also say that they also are African American. And that ought to be a factor in choosing from that pool. Maybe that's one of the considerations.
Because what?
Because diversity of the student body is a healthy factor.
I'm fascinated with the extent to which words, we're conditioned to react like Pavlov's dog to words. I hear diversity. Someone was asking.
That'll make me look bad, professor.
Someone today who was a trustee of a college was saying that they were going to pick a new college professor. I said, what you should do is have a stopwatch there and just count how long it is to each of the contestants says the word diversity. And the guy who says that, you know, he's 35 minutes into the interview, the other guy who says that, you know, the first sentence, the guy who said it takes 35 minutes, he should be at the top of the list. The guy who said it the first sentence should be at the bottom. Because
what's wrong with diversity? I don't get the point.
My point is that this is a word that has become magic. What does it mean, if anything? Are you saying to me that all black people are alike, therefore you've got to mix and match by race? is not diverse unless it's diverse along the
dimensions. No, I'll tell you what I'm saying. I'm saying that I think it would be different to have people of different kinds of experiences. And we mentioned Sri Lanka, didn't we? And, you know, and it'd be interesting to have some people with an Asian background.
Wait,
an Asian background, African American, people that come from Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue, as well as from Henderson, North Carolina. All of that would make a healthy student body.
You mean to tell
me? I don't think everybody ought to come from sons of Harvard graduates.
Places like Harvard and Stanford and Cornell. What you have is the black son of the black doctor,
right,
who lived in the same neighborhood with the white son of the white doctor.
Right. No,
and now you're giving me diversity because these two people
not necessarily. They have scholarships that they offer to kids
But now we're getting away from the whole racial thing. I'm saying the racial thing has been used as a proxy for something that is not a proxy for. Because the vast majority of blacks who go to places like Harvard and Cornell and Stanford are not blacks from the ghetto. Those are blacks from out there. You know, they're from Malibu. You know, they're from Pacific Palisades. They're from the very same neighborhood as the whites are there. And so now you call it diversity because you see something with the naked eye.
Charlie Rose is an excellent interviewer and very highly regarded, but you even notice with him, he gets kind of tongue-tied with the question of diversity and why is it valuable. Like, it's a quick fix. Like, well, we want to be more diverse, but then when someone gets pressed on it, it's kind of like, well, and it gets very complicated very fast. And I think Professor Sewell brought up a good point that, you know, if you look at, let's say, the African-Americans at Harvard and the social class of many of the African Americans at Harvard, they come from a high SES background. And so using race as sort of the indicator isn't necessarily accomplishing the outcomes that the university is desiring. Maybe it was Justin who said it, of not basing it on race, but basing it on class, doing affirmative action based on the class status. And a theory or principle I want to sort of highlight is this idea of individual and structural. This relates to the fundamental attribution error that we talked about on Tuesday. And there's two ways to explain a particular outcome in a person's life. And people tend to have one or the other type of orientation or a way of viewing the world and a way of explaining particular outcomes. And the vast majority have an individual orientation. They look at the individual internal characteristics of the person. And when they see a particular outcome, they have individual explanations for that outcome. And that's where we talked about the fundamental attribution error. If a white person gets into Harvard, they would say, well, the explanation for that is they look at how hard they worked in high school, how well they scored on the entrance exams, their eloquence in writing, their purpose statement. And it's almost 99%, almost 100% of the explanation for them getting in is based on individual characteristics. And yet, there's also structural factors that explain that outcome. Perhaps that high SES student who got into Harvard took a class, paid a couple $1,000s to take a class on how to prepare for the SAT exam. And so when they went in to take that exam, they nailed it because they've been training for the past 6 months on how to ace the SAT exam. And they had transportation to and from the tutoring session, or maybe even the tutor, a private tutor, to help them with the SAT exam. Also, it happened to be that that high SES person had a parent who was English professor and was excellent at training them in how to write extremely well and maybe even help them to write their statement. And maybe they're the fourth generation of persons to go to college. And then the networks, they maybe knew someone who was a professor at the university that they're applying to. And so their social networks. These are all things that are outside of the individual, but what I would describe as structural explanations for why that person was accepted into an elite program. But what we tend to do is think about the individual characteristics and ignore possibly structural explanations, partially because the individual characteristics are much easier to see. The structural ones are just very difficult to observe and even comprehend. We just don't think in terms of networks. We don't think in terms of generations. But all of these things play a strong role in explaining particular outcomes. Now, there's people who sort of are all about the individual actor, and it's all about the individual of explaining particular outcomes in their life, whether they're positive outcomes or negative outcomes. And then there's people on this extreme who say, you know, it really doesn't matter who you are as an individual, it's your place in society that is going to predict your outcomes. Like the structural forces are so strong that you don't even have a chance. If you grew up in a low SES community, the likelihood of having a positive outcome, no matter how good of a person you are so slim because these structural forces are so strong that you don't have a chance. Now, I don't really think it's beneficial to have extreme views on either side. I think what's really healthy is to sort of say, okay, what are the individual characteristics that contributed to this particular outcome? And what are the structural factors that also contributed to this outcome? And what were the positive structural factors? If you had certain social networks or if you had certain resources available to you that other people didn't have, it's important to acknowledge that versus sort of saying, hey, look at me. Look what I accomplished. You know, we both had equal opportunity to get into this program or to get this job, and I performed better. When in reality, there were probably structural factors, resources that were available to me, resources in terms of people, resources in terms of finances, resources in terms of skill sets that were available to some people and not available to others. And so a lot of times, the idea of being intentional about how we view people and their experiences, whether it be in admitting to colleges or to jobs, is to also look into what is their structural position in society, whether it's a high SES structural position or even, you know, a structural position can be by gender. If your structural position is male, then you have certain resources or benefits that are accrued to you compared to someone who is female in different situations. And so to me, it's very important first to understand these two distinctions. Both are social realities. There are individual characteristics that can explain certain outcomes, but there's also structural characteristics that can equally explain certain outcomes and be even more powerful than the individual. And so this idea of the fundamental attribution error and how we explain certain outcomes, we almost need to take a step back and do an assessment of, okay, well, what are the different factors at play? What are the individual factors and what are the structural factors? So I want to transition to talk about your own personal lives and where, not necessarily where your structural position is, but where your social position is on this campus. And I want you to write down all the different social groups or groups that you're involved with on campus. So it doesn't just have to be social groups. It could be academic groups, vocational groups, athletic groups. So just write down all the different student groups that you have some sort of affiliation with. Okay, now I want you to single out what you would say are the three most significant groups that you're a part of. So give me some of the groups that you're involved with on campus.
Recreational sports.
Okay. Other groups?
Justin.
Fraternity.
Fraternity. Jeff.
SPIA.
SPIA. Any group within SPIA or just SPIA writ large?
Nonprofit Leadership Alliance.
Nonprofit Leadership, okay.
I like started my own nonprofit at the school, so I guess I'm like...
What's the name of it?
SAT Urban Sedge Scholarship.
Urban Scholarship?
Yeah.
Other groups?
IUDM. Indiana University Dance Marathon.
IUDM, okay. How long do you dance for?
36 hours.
Impressive. Other groups?
Culture of Care.
Culture of Care. Trent, what's a group that you're involved with?
I'm not playing this year with the rugby team.
Rugby, okay. Charlie?
I literally just go to school here, that's it.
Okay. You don't affiliate with any other people on this campus?
Not really.
Okay. So you would be called an isolate.
Yeah.
There's a survey question that asks, name the people that you talk important things about that you talk with, and there are people out there who would say, I don't have any social ties, and they're social isolates, and that number is actually increasing in society. Okay, so what I want you to do then is, what did I say, pick your top three most important ones, and in terms of race of these, if it's highly racially diverse, give it a score of 10, and if it's very racially homogeneous, give it a score of 1. So each of the groups by race, and then by gender, if it's gender diverse, where it's like really 50-50, give it a score of 10, where if it's very homogeneous, give it a score of 1. And then with class, if it's class diverse, give it a score of 10. If it's class homogeneous, give it a score of 1. And then religion. So if people are all of sort of the same religion, give it a score of 1. And if it's very religiously diverse, give it a score of 10. So the maximum score you could have would be 120 total is the max. So did anyone score over 100? Okay, did anyone score over 80? Did anyone score over 60? Okay, tell us about your groups and sort of how you got that score.
Like SPE as a whole, like the SPE group, and then like the high school I went to, and then like my work environment.
Okay. Yeah, that's very good. Yes, Justin, what's your score? 55, okay. So, and you said fraternity?
It's between the student scholarship, fraternity, and intramural league.
Okay. Who had a lower score, like below 20? Raise your hand if you had a score below 20. And can you, either of you guys, describe sort of just the groups that you, these are your top three groups, and describe them.
Now I'm just an isolate.
You're an isolate, yes. Okay, so now then, another question. With these groups, is there any group that you're involved with where you are a minority within that particular social group? So, you know, we talk about diverse, and the implied thing is that if the group is homogeneous, it's homogeneous around you. So, like, if it's a group that's predominantly a fraternity and it's homogeneous, you would think, oh, I'm in a white fraternity. But it could be the situation that the group is highly homogeneous, but you're actually a minority in the midst of that homogeneity, and you're actually adding to the diversity. Did anyone list a group where you actually, either along race, class, or gender, or religion, where you're actually a minority in that group? Is anyone in a group where you actually are a minority within that group? Justin.
I'm the only Persian kid in my fraternity.
Only Persian kid, okay. Great. Anyone else? Luke.
I'm a server at Texas Roadhouse, and I'm like one of the only guy servers.
Okay. Yeah, so you're a gender minority in terms of servers. Trent.
I'd say at my work, majority of the people are 30 or above.
Okay. So age.
Age, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very good. So, to me, observing this, my thought would be that we are missing out on an opportunity. You know, and a lot of you in your questions of, well, how do you overcome discrimination? How do you overcome implicit bias? One of the best ways possibly to do it is by immersing myself in a situation where I'm a clear minority. And it's amazing what happens. So for me, I went to this student conference several years ago, but it was a conference for African-American students. And there was over 1,500 black students, predominantly African-American students, at this conference, and about 30 non-black students. And it was a week-long conference in Atlanta. And I describe it as one of the worst weeks of my life. And the main reason why it was the worst week of my life is because I didn't enjoy myself at all. I felt out of place the entire week. I didn't understand the jokes. I didn't understand the games that were being played. I was silenced in social settings where normally I'm very talkative and I like to interact with people. I just kind of found myself being put, sort of moving myself out of the conversations. And like when they were playing games, I couldn't, they were playing dominoes, and I couldn't really figure out the rules and the terminology that was being used. Even though I love to play games, I couldn't figure it out, and I didn't want to make a fool of myself by doing the wrong move or doing a move that looked stupid. When they were referencing different movies, I didn't know what the references were, so I couldn't contribute to the conversation. And I bet you almost everyone at that conference, well, first of all, I was invisible to them. They didn't even think about me. They didn't even really care. But the ones who might have thought about me and looked at me would have said, wow, that guy's really shy, or that guy doesn't talk much, or that guy's not much fun. And I felt like very misunderstood, either overlooked or misunderstood. And when I share about that experience with my friends who are racial and ethnic minorities, they're like, that's often my everyday experience in life, of getting overlooked, being misunderstood, being pegged as being something that I'm not, because they're living in an environment where they are the minority. I endured it for 1 week and I hated it. Imagine a lifetime. Imagine not having the luxury of being able to just sort of leave the conference. Most people who are ethnic or racial minorities immersed in a majority culture don't have that luxury. And I think for me, by doing that, and it wasn't just like, oh, I'm going to show up to this social, but it was a week-long experience. But even I think if you show up to one event, you can get a taste of it, and that's all it is a taste. It's just a taste. It's not the reality of what someone might experience who's living this day to day. But it'll give you a taste of sort of, well, gosh, what is it to be a minority within a culture? And for anyone who wants to do it, you can do it as extra credit of just going to some social group on campus where you are a minority. And whether it's group meeting or whatever the event is, a social or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's just basically putting yourself in a situation where you're the clear minority and just writing a personal memo response, similar like the class memo or class response reflection. Just do that, where you go to some group on campus and all you need to do is write basically a half-page description of the experience, of what it felt like to be the minority in a particular setting. One of the things that I found related to this is, and it's what's discussed in the book, is this idea of in-group heterogeneity and out-group homogeneity. So the idea is, within my group, and let's say my group is white people, I see all the diversity, different types of white people in my social settings. There's the whole spectrum or continuum of different differences and variety within my group, the in-group heterogeneity, and out-group homogeneity. When I look at Asian Americans, it's like they're kind of all the same. And yet, when I look at the white people, I see all the diversity and variety. And growing up in the Midwest and graduated high school in upstate New York, there was 5 Asian Americans in my graduating class. And they fit stereotype brilliantly. They were the ones who were in the honors classes. They were more quiet, more reserved, more socially awkward. Their English wasn't as fluent in English as people who were native speakers of English. It just sort of was like, when I thought of Asian people, they're all the same. There is no variety. It's just there's a certain way of being Asian, and it's very homogeneous. I went to college out in California, where there were more the higher proportion of Asian American students at my university than there were Caucasian students. And when I was immersed in that culture and exposed to a large percentage of Asian Americans, I instantly saw the incredible variety and heterogeneity within the Asian American population. I saw the partiers, I saw the athletes, I saw the ones who studied hard, I saw the humanities majors, Asian students, because before all of them were going to engineering or medicine, but I saw, wow, there's a sociologist who's Asian American. And I saw the incredible heterogeneity. But our tendency is to only see within our group as being very diverse and seeing the variety, and then the out-group is being all the same, being very homogeneous. And so that's a tendency that influences the ways that we approach different social categories. Now I want to transition to talking about aversive racism, which is in the text, and I think it's a confusing concept, and we're going to watch a couple video clips that sort of try to unpack it and explain it. But the best way for me to understand aversive racism is this idea called racism without racists. So the idea is that we live in a society where racism persists even though there are no longer any racists in society. So in the sort of the foundations of this theory, it was Eduardo Bonilla Silva, who's a professor at Duke University, who sort of crystallized this theory. And the idea is that if you look at social survey statistics, you know, in up until probably like the 70s or 80s, people had very racist views, blatantly racist views about, particularly about whites against blacks. But then over time, these racist views were diminished. Like, it just, people were just less racist based on these social surveys. But the idea was that we weren't necessarily becoming less racist, we were becoming better at answering survey questions about race. So if someone asked me a question on a survey of, do you think people should be treated equally regardless of their race, I kind of know what the right answer is, and I'm going to say that answer. Or if someone asked me, Fred, do you value diversity? I kind of know what the right answer is. And so even though I might have a different lived experience or sort of different actions in my personal life, I'm going to answer a survey question, a research question, I'm going to say, yes, I value diversity. Yes, people should be treated equally regardless of their race. But what exists, though, is that racism still persists, even though we as a general public are more nuanced in how we answer or discuss things related to race. And so one of the things in my research that I try to get at is I want to know how is race or other different forms of diversity dealt with. And so one question that I'd ask of a student group or a group on an organization is, to what extent did racial differences prolong your meeting? So if you're a leader of an organization and you have racial diversity within your organization, I'll ask, to what extent did racial differences prolong your meeting? Now, if you're the director of an organization, what's the socially appropriate response to that question? If you're trying to game the survey and look good, is it better for racial differences to prolong a meeting or not? It's unclear. And so what that allows me to discover is how deeply are they engaging racial differences? So if racial differences do prolong their meetings, that's actually an indicator that they're deeply engaging racial differences and talking about race. They're not necessarily having just a colorblind posture where like, oh yeah, it doesn't affect our meetings at all. And so what's been done over time is this research, very innovative research on how to detect people having aversive racism, or another way that it's described is implicit bias, where there's this unconscious bias that we have that we don't even know until we sort of go through these different exercises. And so we're going to watch three different videos back to back that are just short clips. The first one explains this concept of implicit bias, and then the next two are going to transition into these what's called microaggressions or micro inequities, which are these everyday flashpoint encounters that are just, they're not these blatant, overt KKK demonstrations of racism, but they're just these little subtle microaggressions related to racism.
Our problem is that the new American dilemma isn't so simple. We have all of these markers by which we can demonstrate that we're not the people we used to be. But we don't know the ways in which we're not such good people, because that part is unconscious. You may think this about yourself, but is that really who you are? We actually created a test that measures bias. You see words that capture good and bad. You have to associate Yankees with good and Red Sox with bad. very easy for a Yankee fan. But when you tell them to associate Yankee with bad and Red Sox with good, that's an impossible thing for them to do. They can't do it. They'll make mistakes. They'll take a lot longer to do it, and so on. Take a test like this and now just replace Red Sox and Yankees with the groups black and white. Imagine that for half the trials on this test, you have to associate black with good whenever you see a black face or a word like love, peace, joy, friend, all these good things. And while you're doing that, you have to put white and bad together and words that mean terrible things in the world, words like agony, devil, bomb, vomit. How hard is that for you to do, is the question. We're not talking about your conscious attitudes. We're not talking about your conscious beliefs. We're talking about something that you yourself may not necessarily know you have. For something like 75% of white Americans, it's very hard to put black and good together.
You've done it. And it's even been done to you. You shake a person's hand, but barely make eye contact. You sit in on a colleague's presentation and repeatedly glance down at your watch. Maybe you've even seen your leaders frequently mispronounce an employee's name. And how do you explain the random yet consistently convenient exclusion of Dave, the disabled veteran, from the team social event? It turns out these seemingly unrelated acts of disrespect have a name. They're called micro-inequities, and their impact goes far deeper than what meets the eye. When micro-inequities accumulate to block employees' contributions and cause disengagement, they transcend the personal and become a major business issue. On October 30th, at the Sherman Diversity Inclusion Conference, we will explore how to identify these micro-inequities, including those that are not so easy to see. We will discuss the impact of micro-inequities on individuals and teams. And yes, you will walk away with an understanding of how to strategically replace micro-inequities with macro-affirmations. If you are planning to come to this year's conference in San Francisco, this is the session you will want to attend. Yes, I know it's going to be early. So join me for coffee, and let's get started.
Oh, you're so pretty for a black girl.
Oh, she has a Jew nose.
Oh, your hair would look so good if it was straight.
Jews are so cheap. Why are you so cheap?
Do you speak good English?
How are you an Iraqi Jew?
I think the person saying microaggression kinda doesn't really think about it.
This person who said it was my friend, and like, I was astonished they would like say something like that.
You don't wanna make a big deal about it, but then it's also like, you just said something that offended me, so I feel like I should speak up.
Because they're micro, because they're very subtle, they're small, you feel like you don't have a reason to be upset. You're overreacting, and people even can make you feel that way when you bring it up.
They're like, oh, you can't take a joke. You're making too big of a deal of this. Why are you overreacting?
Don't take it so seriously. It was just a joke. Chill out.
Say like, oh no, I actually love black people. I love people of color. Like, they try to just minimize the situation. If someone feels hurt by a microaggression, it shouldn't just be pushed to the side.
It definitely has these negative impacts and like leads to people disliking who they actually are. Those kinds of subtle offensive comments can build up over time, and they can have like a deep psychological effect, and you know, they can make you feel bad and they can make you doubt yourself.
We try to just use jokes to like make things less awkward or like ease social experiences, but it is important because you need to like be aware of what you're saying and like who you're speaking to.
Think of what you say and how it can affect the person you're saying it to.
A couple of the things with the implicit bias test, I actually took this test, and it's amazing when you just sit down, and basically the way it works is you're just supposed to instinctively basically put good, bad, good, bad, good, bad, and it flashes up things on the screen, and you're just supposed to just instinctively click, you know, one button for good and one button for bad. And it's amazing how, I mean, she said 75% of white people have a difficult time instinctively associating black people with good and white people with bad. This is a way to demonstrate our instinctive reactions. When we walk into a situation or we find ourselves in a scenario, we make quick calculations, instantaneous calculations that really aren't based on full data, but we need to make a quick assessment. And we do that not only just in normal social situations, but in all types of situations, whether it be hiring or choosing leaders or working together in groups, we make these quick, instinctive, instantaneous judgments that are based on stereotypes or impressions that the media puts out there that aren't necessarily accurate. Sometimes it might be, but not always. And yet we put a lot of confidence in our instinctive reactions to those situations. The other one that is talked about is these microaggressions. What's interesting is, as I watch this video, personally, I sit there and I say, I can't relate. I don't really have these experiences of microaggressions. Like, I don't experience aggression from people. But when I talk to my friends who are social minorities and they watch this, they're like, that happens more than you realize. And so I think what I'm curious is, as you guys saw this video about microaggressions or just these subtle social dynamics that go on, do any of you have examples or experiences where either you are sort of, you look at that, you're like, ooh, I said that to my friend. I didn't know that that might have been offensive, or you might have been the recipient of it. I would love to hear that. I recognize that it's probably not the easiest thing to share in a group setting, but it could be a very valuable thing for others to hear in a group setting. And so I'm just curious if you have examples of where either you or maybe the perpetrator, Corey.
I grew up in like an all-white area, and I had there's like four black people in my high school.
Uh-huh.
And I pop a lot of jokes, and there's this black kid, a grade under me, and I'd always go up to his hair and stuff, and it wasn't meant to be like that, but it was just weird for me because, you know, we weren't like that, and he was like the only one in our school who was black, so I guess I kind of did that.
Yeah, so you would see, like, reflecting back, you're like, he probably didn't enjoy that experience of being singled out in that way.
I didn't mean to like go up to him in front of everybody and be like, oh man, look at your crazy hair.
Uh-huh.
Looking back, it's probably what I did.
Sure. No, and that's, I mean, my hope is that this isn't going to be sort of like this crusade or judgment of like, you're all bad. My desire is being very aware of our actions and how they affect other people. And I think that's a huge step of just being cognizant of it. So that's a great example, Corey. Any other examples that you guys can think of, either being the perpetrator at Mercedes?
I went to an all-white high school and middle school and everything else. when I was in high school, like a lot of people used to say, you don't act like a black person, like a regular black person. And I think that's really interesting because what is a black person supposed to act like? And, of course, I know what they're referring to when they mean, like, loud and ghetto and low income, and that's what a black person is in society. And so it kind of got to the point where I'm no longer offended because I really don't care, honestly. But it's just really funny that people can be fascinated with the fact that just because I'm black, I'm not from low income, and just because I'm black, I don't struggle, like, I don't think that defines a black person in America, but it does. And then kind of going off what he was saying, again, when I was in high school, white people are really fascinated with black hair. And I think it's so funny because they always wonder, like, I change my hair all the time, and so I would come to school and they'd be like, hey, your hair grew. And I'm like, no, it's not mine. Why do you get it to stick to your head? And so there's just, like, a lot of things that I don't get offended anymore because I can't fault people for not knowing. And kind of like he was saying, he wasn't doing it to offend the guy, but it's fascinating. And so I just think that we need to learn how to make it accept it as a joke and just explain to people if they really don't know. But these microaggressions, they're not always a negative thing, I think. And I think if we think about it and realize that people really don't know, then I guess we kind of change it around.
That's great, Mercedes. I don't know if we should just blow them off and sort of accept them as jokes, or if we should say, if we should sort of come back, have a very coy response that sort of engages the person, you know, in a nuanced way. Olivia.
What would you say the definition is for microaggression?
Microaggression would be, so like one example that they have is a person is walking down the street, say it's a woman, and she sees a black person walking towards her. She moves to the side, she grabs her purse, and sort of picks up her pace to move fast. That's an example of a microaggression, whereas if it was a white person wearing a suit, walking in the same way, those actions wouldn't, they're subtle, you know, they're moving to the side, they're clutching the purse, they're picking up the pace, versus like the macroaggressions are, I'll say the KKK with the burning crosses in the front yard. Like, that's macro. Like, there's nothing subtle about that, and it's blatant. So we're going to wrap up with this. Starting next week, we're going to start 4 weeks of looking more in depth at different racial and ethnic differences and go from there.